The recording you are about to hear was originally broadcast on February 1st, 2012 on the Free School University program on Occupy Boston Radio, OBR.FM on your internet browser, educational programming by the 99% for the 99%. Hi, welcome to Free School University on Occupy Boston Radio, educational programming by the 99% for the 99%. I'm David Knutnan, your host, and tonight's guest is Dennis Fox. Dennis Fox is an anarchist and a social psychologist who's been involved with Occupy Boston since the beginning, or before the beginning, really. Back in the fall, he taught a number of courses for Free School University at Dewey Square on the intersections of anarchism, psychology, and law, which are topics he began exploring in the 1970s while participating in the Boston Clamshell Alliance and the Coalition for Direct Action at Seabrook. Now he's here in the studio with us to talk about anarchism and democracy and psychology and law and the lessons that are being learned from the Occupy movement. So, Dennis, you're an anarchist, a social psychologist. You specialize in psychology and law. These are maybe not things that most people would think of as meshing all that well together. Could you maybe tell us a little bit about how you happened to come to this particular combination of pursuits?
Sure, and thanks for inviting me. I'm glad to be here and take part in the conversation. I think there are overlaps and disjunctions between those three things, and I came into social psychology as a college student in the late 60s, and saw it as a good way to attack social problems in this kind of liberal, reformist, more knowledge is better approach. And social psychology, if you look at a standard social psychology textbook, it deals with all kinds of things that people find interesting to talk about. Relationships, friendship, attitudes, conformity, mm-hmm. obedience, things that have to do with how people interact with each other, how we learn from each other, influence mm-hmm. each other. And back in the 60s, social psychology, I think, had a very politically liberal approach to reform and solving problems. And I got very much into that as an undergraduate.
So you weren't an anarchist at that time?
An anarchist. I had probably never really come across the term, and I was a teenager and a college student. But I had been, in between high school and college, I spent a year in Israel. And part of that year I spent on a kibbutz, which mm-hmm. is a collective settlement. There were, at that point, about 250 settlements following what was called the socialist model, but I've since read more history of it. Back in the teens, in the 1920s, kibbutzim followed a more of an explicitly anarchist model. There were anarchists involved in creating them. People were reading anarchist theorists from Europe. Mm-hmm. And so it was set up in an anarchist model, but the term is never used, and mm-hmm. I really didn't know that the way I was learning about how small groups of people could interact, sorting things out for themselves and trying to take nothing for granted about the way society is set up, but really taking everything as up for grabs, that mm-hmm. we could rethink mm-hmm. things. So I was introduced to that in that movement. And so when I got into social psychology as an undergraduate, I already had that sense that there's nothing that we have to assume is forever. Mm-hmm. And in social psychology at that point seemed, maybe I think naively, it seemed to me that could be a way to get to bigger issues rather than just tinkering with liberal reforms. But they're still sort of pretty removed in my activities then. And it was only a few years later, I kind of started graduate school in social psychology, and then I was interested in issues of social movements, and I was doing research on mm-hmm. social movement participation, people, and doing a lot of reading about and of people who got involved in political change and social change. And then I left graduate school for unrelated reasons and moved to Boston a few years later and got involved with a group of people who were doing community gardening, living together in several households in Cambridge and Somerville, mm-hmm. Described what they were doing as libertarian socialism, which is how it was described in the ad in the Real Paper or the Phoenix mm-hmm. or wherever I saw their ad. And we had study groups, and we would read mostly anarchist writers. Murray Bookchin was very active in New England then and had written a lot and was very influential in a lot of anarchists of the time. And I didn't really know what I was an anarchist. And at one point, someone in the group asked me if I was an anarchist. And I said, well, I don't know enough mm-hmm. about it to know, but a lot of this just makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I went back to graduate school 7 or 8 years later that I went back to continue in social psychology and really saw how the two fit together, mm-hmm. that the essence of social psychology is this relationship of the individual to other people, the individual to the community and the society, mm-hmm. and how you mesh that thing together. And the more I learned about anarchism, the more I discovered that that's what anarchism is about, that anarchism isn't a do-your-own-thing movement only. And it's always, even back in the 60s when people were getting into it more in this country, as I sort of read about later, it was do your own thing with a group. Mm-hmm. You know, it was do your own thing, but we want to have a commune. We want to work together and live together. And so there was always this acknowledgement in modern anarchism as well in historical anarchism that the way to create a society is not just to do your own thing and not just to give up everything for the sake of the group, but try to find a way you can do both of those things at the same time. Mm-hmm. This is something that Emma Goldman wrote about 100 years ago, that other anarchist writers in the late 1800s, early 1900s were writing about, that that anarchists want to change the world so that people can be different, but we can't change the world unless we're different, mm-hmm. that we can't... go about making changes that we can't be different than we know how to be. So that anarchists might want to live cooperatively, work together effectively, and be supportive, but we grew up in circumstances where we didn't really learn those skills very well.
So we have to learn as we're going. It has to be built as you go along. But maybe we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. I'm realizing that... I think, you know, people in the Occupy Boston community probably have a better sense of what anarchism means maybe than the general public does, but probably some of our listeners may not have a very clear idea of what anarchism is. And anarchism has been associated with a lot of bad things in our society, with, you know, bomb throwing and violence and mm-hmm. and sort of radicalism that of a form that doesn't allow of any organization whatsoever. I'm not saying that's right, mm-hmm. but I'm saying those are mm-hmm. common biases. So maybe you should spend a little bit of time just talking for our listeners about what anarchism is and isn't.
Sure. And I can tell you what it is and isn't to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we had half a dozen anarchists here, we might all come up with different definitions and different, different historical takes on things. But to me, anarchism... in sort of the classical modern sense, developing in the 1800s, was a political movement to change society for the benefit of working class people. And in many cases, it was largely a labor movement. Mm-hmm. The IWW, which still exists now, the Industrial Workers of the World, you know, was largely an anarchist model of organization, and it was very much labor focused for a lot of people. And in Europe in the 1800s,
that model was called anarcho-syndicalism often, right?
Right. And if you look on Wikipedia, there's about 2 dozen kinds of anarchism listed: anarcho-syndicalism and anarcho-feminism and anarcho-communism and post-anarchism and there's also a sort of anarchism without adjectives, which is little easier for me to grasp. And anarchists in Europe in the 1800s worked often with Marxists. Anarchism initially was seen as just one form of Marxism, one form of socialism, and the goal was a society run without hierarchy, a society run without a political state. And the split, I'm not a historian, but the split, as I understand it, between anarchists and Marxists in the 1800s came about because the Marxists kind of envisioned the stateless society being some future utopian goal, you know, that first we would need a state, a dictatorship of the proletariat, and eventually someday that would wither away and we'd have true communism mm-hmm. without a state. Anarchists didn't think that we'd ever get there if we set up this intervening dictatorship of the proletariat. And so anarchists kept complaining about the way the international Marxist organizations were being run and what they were doing, saying that this is just replacing one set of rulers for another. Mm-hmm. And eventually the anarchists were kicked out or left the larger Marxist world. Emma Goldman was making the same point about the Soviet Union. When the Soviet Union came into existence, Emma Goldman went to the Soviet Union and began complaining about the way the society was being set up with just a different set of rulers. So there's sort of this hostile history between anarchists and Marxists and which affects political movements today, including movements like Occupy and other things. One of the historical things you talked about, sort of the anarchy's reputation for violence and assassination, there was certainly one strain of anarchism, of anarchy as a political movement in the 1800s. There were political assassinations, bomb throwing. There was also frame-ups. The Haymarket affair in Chicago was one example where it's not really clear what happened and who threw a bomb and killed people, but anarchists were blamed and fed into this anti-immigrant hysteria in the early 1900s and the Red Scare in 1919, 1920, where a lot of anarchists and other dissidents were picked up and sent back to Europe, you know, looking at anarchy as a foreign idea brought into America. But even back then, the use of violence was controversial among anarchists. I mean, this was debated among anarchists in the same way that tactics today are debated among anarchists, that some anarchists today argue that the way to be a revolutionary movement is to push the edge, to be confrontational, to do property damage, sometimes to do violence. And we've seen more of violence against people in some anarchist groups in Europe than in the United States. I don't really know of any here where that's happened.
Against people.
But today, as in the past, there are large segments of the anarchist world that are opposed to that and see it as disruptive, see it as counterproductive. There have always been anarchist pacifists. There have always been religious anarchists. The Catholic Workers, which still exists as an activist group, that's an anarchist group of Catholics. Right? So there's a broad range of groups that people are involved in who identify themselves as anarchists, and very few of them are the ones who are who use disruption and forms of property destruction and violence as a tactic. But they're the ones that get all the attention.
They get the press.
And so they get the press, which makes it more likely that people will want to do that.
Which works very well for the press as representatives of the status quo, but we won't maybe go there right now.
It also feeds very much into the kind of the sense for some people that anarchism is just doing whatever you want and nobody can tell me what to do.
Right.
And I think that's probably more true for some younger anarchists mm-hmm. than for older anarchists.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when my daughter turned goth in middle school and got very into the circle A symbol, mm-hmm. you know, it was real clear that what kids her age were into was, no one can tell me what to do, I do what I want, and that meant anarchy.
Right.
And I think mostly when people get older and they learn more about anarchy historically and about the theory and they actually have to work with groups of people, they kind of drop that, which for some is a pose, or they become kind of anarcho-capitalist libertarians who we could talk a little about, but there are people on the right, often supporters of Ron Paul, for example,
right.
who might call themselves anarchists because they don't believe there should be a political state, but they are not anti-capitalist.
Right.
And anarchy as a political movement, anarchism as a political movement, was very much anti-capitalist
right.
from the very beginning. And so the way that the term libertarian has moved from being associated with anarchists to being associated with capitalists is sort of a galling development
right.
for people who like the term libertarian but can't use it anymore now because
right.
it makes it look like you're for Ron Paul.
Well, the contrast you were talking about between a sort of an immature idea or a teenage idea of anarchy as being you can't tell me what to do and a more, maybe more mature version actually would segue nicely back to where I interrupted you from, which is where you were talking about anarchists being focused both on the individual autonomy and on community. So maybe you want to talk a little bit more about what those two things mean to anarchy. And also, I think in your work, you've connected those ideas to sort of psychological theory as well.
Right, and that gets right back into my sense of social psychology, mm-hmm. which the typical social psychology course in mainstream texts has this list of very disconnected topics. But what they have in common is they often have to do with this tension between the individual and other people, mm-hmm. with working in groups, with friendship, with figuring out my own needs versus what my obligations or responsibility is to the group. Mm-hmm. So that and not just in social psychology, in other areas of psychology, in child psychology, there's a big focus on how infants who are very self-focused grow and learn that there are other people, that other people have needs, that other people's needs matter, and learn to negotiate their own needs, their own sense of self, with their sense of other people. Mm-hmm. In personality psychology, man, there are dozens of different personality theorists mm-hmm. historically, but what they often have in common is they see this tension between the growing individual personality and other people as a core of the personality theory. How do we become who we are? Because whoever we are is, to a very large extent, the reflection of the group that we're in. Mm-hmm. You know, there may be temperamental tendencies that we're born with, but the things that we grow up to become because we're in interaction with other people. Mm-hmm. A person in isolation wouldn't be a recognizably social human being, wouldn't mm-hmm. have language, wouldn't be able to communicate. And so in psychology, this tension between how we grow up in society is at the core of a lot of what modern psychology mm-hmm. is about. Anarchism looks at that same tension. That anarchism looks at this and says, well, there's something wrong with the way we're growing up. There's something mm-hmm. wrong with the society. There's inequality, there's oppression, there's repression. So we want to change them. And only by changing both, only by working on both levels at the same time, can we actually do that. And anarchists have from the very beginning, anarchists have been involved in setting up schools, setting up free schools mm-hmm. For young children with a real clear awareness. Lots of political groups set up schools because, you know, the thinking is if we get kids when they're young, we can help shape them. And so anarchists have tried to do that too and create up schools that were less rigid or that focused on different values. Anarchists have set up intentional communities trying to change the way that resources were shared, the way work was divided up, the way family life developed in the Israeli kibbutz system that I mentioned before mm-hmm. For a very long period. And starting pretty early, there was a sense that a lot of the problems that individuals faced stemmed from, I guess, poor family dynamics. And that basically the argument seemed to be that parents screw up a lot of kids. And that one way of trying to
My kids would agree with you. Yeah. I agree with that, I think.
Well, there's a lot of that going around. And I think the part of the rationale, although this wasn't the initial thing, was sort of a more practical thing, but over time this ideology developed that rather than having children grow up completely in a nuclear family, mm-hmm. It was better for the children to live separately from the family for much of the day and the week. Mm-hmm. And so this notion of children's houses developed as a way where children would actually sleep in a house separate from the parents, who would mm-hmm. have their own room and then later their own apartment, and that there would be trained people who would work with the kids, and every day the children would spend time with their parents, but the parents weren't the ones who were disciplining the kids for not doing what they were supposed to. The parents weren't the ones teaching them to tie their shoes.
They weren't what we'd call the primary caretakers.
They weren't the primary...
distributed, but they were to the whole community, it sounds like.
Right. It wasn't their responsibility to make their kids crazy. That was someone's job. And so there's a lot of research in the 1950s and 1960s by child psychologists, did a lot of research on kibbutz child rearing to see what happened to these kids and what it did to the bonds. And the research was mixed and interesting. It did sort of cut into the bonds between parents and children in some ways. It strengthened them within the peer group. But not all the parents like that. And there are other changes going on in the kibbutz, and no kibbutz has a children's house anymore. Huh. And so they've all gotten rid of them. But it was an example of an anarchist effort to make changes in very basic things. Mm-hmm. Just like the early kibbutz, like a lot of anarchist communities, there's no marriage. In the early kibbutz, there was no marriage. And people would move to live together or not. And it was mm-hmm. up to them. There was no ceremony. There was no official involvement. And even 100 years ago, at the time Emma Goldman was around and earlier, free love was an anarchist concept portrayed as a feminist concept by Emma Goldman and others. This was a way to free women to have power in their relationships in a way that they didn't have in traditional marriage and traditional patriarchy. Right. And so that history's also gone through a lot of changes.
Well, the counterexample they had in the traditional marriage was, in fact, a very dominant one. It doesn't necessarily mean that open relationships are the only alternative to that.
No.
But it seems like you've been talking about mostly ways in which anarchists try to relate to the community part of that dichotomy or whatever you want to call it. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about the autonomy and how does that relate?
Yeah, I think anarchists for the most part are suspicious of people with power to tell other people what to do. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of anarchists make a distinction between going along with a group that you have decision-making power in mm-hmm. and just following rules. And, social psychologists have studied the same thing, although they don't use terms like anarchy when they do that, but social psychologists have known for years that if you want a group of people to follow a rule, then the group of people should make up the rule. That if people are invested in setting up a structure, they're more likely to own it, they're more likely to be cooperative within it, they're more willing to go along with the group decision, even if they don't like it, than if somebody just tells people what to do. And so anarchists try to set up structures where decisions are group made instead of made by individuals, and to the extent possible, try to set up situations where people can decide not to go along with the group when it's not disruptive to the group. So instead of enforcing a uniform set of principles or activities on everybody, you try to leave in room for individuals to have as much autonomy as they can retain without it being destructive to the group. And that's a difficult thing to do because people have different senses of how much is too much. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the experimentation in anarchy, in intentional community, in anarchist work groups is trying to find that balance. And there are psychologists, some pretty well-known psychologists of the past, who have looked at that and have called this anarchist notion a hypothesis. Paul Goodman is somebody, Abraham Maslow. These are psychologists who looked at anarchy as a set of hypotheses about how people can function without hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And the idea was you experiment with different ways. Mm-hmm. First you try this way, and then you try that way, and you learn things, and each way has pros and cons, and you try to come up with a way where people cannot have to give up their sense of what they want to be doing with their lives, and the group still functions as a group that makes it possible for people to do what they want to do with their lives. Mm-hmm. Abraham Maslow taught a course in the late 40s called Utopian Social Psychology. And the course description was something like, how ideal a society does human nature allow? How ideal human nature does society allow? Mm-hmm. What is possible and what is not? Mm-hmm. That's an anarchist way of looking at the connection between those two. And Maslow talked about anarchy and talked about anarchism as the level of development for people, basically for people who could get there.
Right.
You saw it as a very high level.
One objection I think that's often leveled against anarchism or any philosophy that has what we might call utopian elements is that it requires human nature to change, and somehow people think human nature can't change. But what you're basically saying is, well, that's a hypothesis that human nature can't change. For all we know, human nature can change. And so the anarchism or part of anarchism is really about trying to figure out exactly what human nature can do and can't do, and how good people, as you just said, mm-hmm. how good people actually can be, and and how good a society they can make, rather than making assumptions about it based strictly on our history of past societies. Does that sound fair?
Although I don't know that anarchists are trying to figure out human nature so much as figuring out what we can actually do. Mm-hmm. I mean, anarchists don't all agree about human nature and what that means, and psychologists certainly don't agree about that. Generally, I think anarchists historically have seen human nature in a more positive sense than people who support authoritarian government, you know, and people who think that the only reason that we operate as a society is because the state and the government and the police and the legal system make us do the right thing. Mm-hmm. That otherwise it would be like a Hollywood movie where without the government, we would just end up all killing each other.
Sort of Hobbesian view.
Right, very Hobbesian view that life in nature.
If somebody wasn't telling us what to do, we'd all be bad.
Right. And anarchists, I think, point out that most of what we do every day is not that bad. Mm-hmm. Even the nastiest person you can think of, most of what that person does all day isn't all that bad. Mm-hmm. You know, they have kids, they say hello to people, they don't like attack everybody that they mm-hmm. come across. Mm-hmm. Most of us, if there was no law against murder, most of us would not go out and find somebody to kill.
Right.
All right, so most of what we do is actually pretty good. But it's only the bad things that people point at and say, that's just human nature.
Right.
You know, no one says that when people are selfless. No one says that when people share. No one says that when people are kind. You never hear someone say, that's just human nature. It's only the negative. So there's this, I think anarchists are more focused on the positives of human nature and more interested in finding examples where that's more obvious at a community and societal level, mm-hmm. which is why there's been a lot of focus in anarchism on anthropology. A lot of anthropologists have specialized in looking for examples around the world, some mm-hmm. still existing, mm-hmm. on small societies, hunter-gatherer societies, small village societies that operate in various ways without rigid hierarchy, without a legal system, without patriarchy, without anybody in a formal position to tell other people what to do, mm-hmm. and without a formal body of people to enforce rules.
Yeah.
And those societies exist. And those societies were the dominant form of human existence for 95% of our history. Mm-hmm. All of this stuff about states and governments and organized religion and agriculture and cities, this is all the last 10,000 years.
Right.
It's a drop in the bucket in terms of what we've evolved to become.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've actually, one of my interest is actually classical democracy, like Athenian democracy, and I've been reading. I'm surprised at how many writers who write about that sort of assume that everything before that was monarchy, that democracy in Athens was a brand new thing because before everything was kings. Mm-hmm. And I know enough about anthropology to know that isn't necessarily true, but I'm surprised to see how many people seem to assume that it's true. That it's a very Hobbesian idea, I think, that if people don't have a strong leader, then they will be bad.
I think Rousseau said about Hobbes is the trouble with Hobbes is he was only talking about the people that he knew.
Mm-hmm. That's right, and he didn't know some very, he knew some not very good people. I just want to remind our listeners that you are listening to Free School University on Occupy Boston Radio, OBR-FM on your internet browser. And I'd like to tell people that Occupy Boston Radio needs your support. Go to OBR-FM and click on the link that says Help to Support OBR. Your donation will make sure we have equipment to broadcast on and studio space to broadcast from. Don't let the voice of the 99% go silent. Please support OBR today. Now back to Dennis Fox. So one of your other interests is law and anarchism. And
that's an odd thing.
sounds kind of contradictory, but I remember looking and reading some of your work, and one thing that struck me was a critique you had that sort of critiqued the potential for injustice in a legal system on three levels, three different mm-hmm. levels. One was sort of the individual bad people who are, you know, corrupt people who are breaking the law and not doing what they should. Another one was sort of the level of bad laws. And the third one was an anarchist critique of the whole concept of law at all. I just thought that was very interesting. I think our listeners would be interested, too, if you'd want to expound on that a little bit.
Yeah, I started looking at the legal system sort of accidentally because I ended up with doing postdoctoral work in psychology and law, which mm-hmm. is a subspecialty now of social psychology and other areas of psychology. And I didn't really want to be a lawyer, but it seemed to me that there were a lot of assumptions built into law and the legal system, and, you know, it's a very powerful institution. Mm-hmm. And it really helped sitting in law classes as part of my postdoctoral work with an anarchist perspective on things, interpreting the way legal thinking is taught to law students. And that's the purpose of law school. It's not to actually teach lawyers how to go out and do contracts or something. It's mm-hmm. to understand legal reasoning, how judges reason when they have an appellate decision. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons, and I discovered that sometimes philosophy students have trouble with law school because they although they're very good at the logic, they're used to questioning basic assumptions. Mm-hmm. And law doesn't question basic assumptions. So in mm-hmm. a class on property, you never get to question why is property important. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the given. And then the legal system follows from that underlying concept. Mm-hmm. For me, it's real clear, and I think a lot of people recognize that law can be used for bad ends. And that's not news. I mean, we all, you know, the United States right. has a horrendous history where lots of horrible things were legal.
Right, and still are.
And you know, we'd like to think that we've changed those specific things.
Mm-hmm. Or some of them, anyway.
Right, and so we complain about other legal systems that have things that we don't no longer have in our mm-hmm. legal system. Mm-hmm. We like to think ours is better.
And people in Europe complain or like to think that theirs is better because we still have the death penalty in this country.
Right. We have all kinds of things. But the way we tend, as you pointed out, the way we tend to complain about law is first to complain about the people who are making the law or enforcing the law. Mm-hmm. So if we change, you know, we might have corrupt judges or we might have racist cops mm-hmm. or we might have politicians who don't have our interests in heart. So if we just elect different politicians, they'll make better laws. Mm-hmm. Or if we get rid of bad judges, we'll have better judges. Mm-hmm. And we people make fun of them. We make fun of lawyers. You know, they're endless lawyer yes. jokes. A lot of which, you know, make sense, except lawyers have defenses of all of that. We have, you know, complaints about judges. But the solution is always to just change the personnel. There's nothing wrong with the system. And then right. sort of this higher level, the middle level, is, well, we just need to change the kind of people who are making decisions, not just get more honest people or better skilled people, but people who have a different perspective on what the purpose of law is. Mm-hmm. So we might want to get more working class people into Congress mm-hmm. so that there'll be more people in Congress who understand what it's like to be poor and working class and middle class instead of having Congress filled with millionaires. Mm-hmm. Right?
Or more women or more minorities or something. You can right. have many different ways to try to get a different perspective in there. And
right. So the idea is if we have a different political sense of who creates the laws and how we enforce them, then the law will be changed to reflect the interests of the majority, mm-hmm. the 99%.
Yeah.
Anarchists tend to look at that and argue that the problem, although that would fix some things.
Yes.
The problem is that what you have then is people in the law, the legal system, which is designed to not humanize decisions. Law is designed to replace human interaction. Law is designed to replace the way that people would make decisions if they sat down together to work something out. Right, because that's seen as biased, it's seen as subject to power differentials, it's seen as lacking precedent. And so law is a bureaucracy, but it's a bureaucracy that follows certain logic. And this is the logic that they teach in law school, the logic of making decisions. And the reason that when law students have a question on a test about there's some tenant-landlord issue where the landlord is behaving horribly to the tenant, And sort of the question is, well, who wins in this case? If you answer the tenant wins, you lose, because the logic of the law is it has nothing to do with fairness. Mm-hmm. I remember a law professor, when someone complained and said about a case, that's not fair, the law professor said, go outside, look at the building. It doesn't say school of justice. It says school of law. You know, law and justice law and justice are two different things, and law professors are very clear about that, and the only people who seem to link them are politicians making 4th of July speeches.
Right.
And for them, you know, law is designed to bring about justice. But law professors and many lawyers are really clear.
If you get a doctorate degree in law, you are a doctor of jurisprudence, aren't you?
Right, and jurisprudence is a philosophy of making legal decisions. And it's a logical, principled way and of applying general principles to individual cases. And that's at the heart of law. Mm-hmm. That if you break a law, you're treated the same way as everyone else who breaks that law, mm-hmm. no matter what police officer is around, no matter what judge is enforcing, everyone is treated exactly the same in the concept.
So as I understand it, the anarchist critique is sort of that you can't, that law being based on very broad general principles can't take the particulars of a case into account very well, can't really look at the people who are doing it and why they did it and, you know, what their relationship is and a lot of very particular issues like that. Do you think is that sort of what you're trying to get at?
Right. And the more that judges do that, the more they're departing from the strict rule of law.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the term rule of law is like a good thing in our in our culture. But what the rule of law really means is we don't make exceptions. Mm-hmm. So if someone's on death row and their lawyer misses a deadline, and still has a lawyer, and the lawyer misses a deadline, and the person has to be executed because the lawyer missed a deadline. Well, that's just the way it goes, because the rule of law is more important than looking at the individual circumstances of that case. Every legal system has built into it a way to get around the law. You know, generally it's called an equity system. And it, constitutionally, when our legal system was set up, you know, courts were set up to resolve cases in law and equity. And they've been merged together, and equity is a concept of fairness. Equity is the acknowledgement that sometimes the technicalities of the legal system are so ridiculous that there has to be a way to get around that and act fairly.
Mm-hmm.
But judges hate to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you do that, it
leaves them out on a limb if they do that.
Right. And that comes into every time there's a new nomination for the Supreme Court, we get into that same debate.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to follow the law the way it's written, or are you going to decide on your own what's fair and what's not?
Mm-hmm.
Well, most of what liberals like about the legal changes over the last 30, 40 years have come from judges who ignored what the law said or creatively reinterpreted it in a way to try to be fair. So we got civil rights law, we got changes in law about the rights of women, we got all kinds of changes that are good liberal changes, and it's left a whole generation thinking that that's the function of the Supreme Court, to help us improve. That's actually a very minor part of the Supreme Court's history, and there are a number of books looking at that Supreme Court history. For the most of its existence, the Supreme Court has been very resistant to making changes, as it is now again.
Mm, right.
And so I think anarchists, even those who haven't actually studied the way the law works, but I mean anarchists, an anarchist critique of the law would get into this way that general principle replaces community input, replaces decision making by people who know the people involved, it replaces informal ways of resolving things. And there's a lot of talk about restorative justice and mediation and a lot of things that have come up to try to get away a strict adversarial legal reasoning system. And to the extent that we do those things, we're getting away from law.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to try to bring the conversation back maybe a little bit closer to the Occupy movement. One question I wanted to ask you, in the Occupy movement, one of the terms we often use to describe the way we try to organize ourselves is horizontal democracy, and I wondered if you had thoughts or you could share on how the concept of horizontal democracy relates to some of the anarchist principles that you were talking about, because a lot of the actual practices in the Occupy movement do derive, I believe, from anarchist practices, but yet we don't really call it anarchism; we call it horizontal democracy, and I wondered if you had thoughts about that. I'm sure you do.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And I think from the very beginning, it seemed to me that a lot of the norms that very quickly developed for the Occupy movement came straight out of anarchist theory and practice. Mm-hmm. And not just from there, because, you know, women's groups have often used some of the same things, other groups that use the same thing. But even at Dewey Square, where Occupy Boston began to coalesce as a community, it was very clear that we wanted a decision-making system that we called horizontal democracy that did not involve people with official positions of power. We tried to create structures so that nobody would always be in a position of facilitating things or of making decisions that bond other people. We had a system based on mutual aid. There was no money changing hands. People could come and not have to pay for food and not have to mm-hmm. pay for clothing. There was volunteer work that did all the work. there was a focus on direct action, mm-hmm. which people have different senses of what that means. I think for anarchists, for the most part, one way of looking at direct action is doing what we can ourselves rather than asking someone else to do it, rather than appealing for permission. So when Occupy Boston...
Direct action is acting directly.
It's acting directly. So the decision that Occupy Boston made not to request a permit mm-hmm. to stay in Dewey Square followed from an anarchist direct action principle is that the state doesn't have any right to tell us what to do, mm-hmm. and we're just going to do it because we want to do it. Mm-hmm. We're not going to ask the state's permission. Another form of direct action is setting up... structures and institutions that directly do what we want to accomplish. So helping each other feed ourselves and get clothing and bringing food in is a form of direct action. Mm-hmm. Trying to live today the way we want in the future, which mm-hmm. anarchists sort of call prefigurative politics, mm-hmm. that we act today the way we want to live in the future. Mm-hmm. We don't have a transition where we can be as nasty as the other side and then hope to change that mm-hmm. at some point. Mm-hmm. So horizontal democracy is a term used for a decision-making process that's participatory, where everybody is involved in making decisions. Nobody has the authority to make a decision that binds other people. Only the group has the authority to make decisions. And to the extent possible, people don't have to go along with decisions that they don't like. Mm-hmm. So if the group decides to hold a march and you don't want to go, you don't go. Right. So it seemed to me from the very beginning that the Occupy movement is based very much on these anarchist principles. Mm-hmm. And the problem was that most people in Occupy aren't anarchists. And so we had these principles that the anarchists kind of understood more of the history of, but everyone else came from different perspectives. They were mm-hmm. Marxists, and they were liberals, mm-hmm. and they were Ron Paul people, and people with very different senses. So I think that's been an ongoing issue, and maybe we can get back to that later. But in terms of the democracy, I think anarchists, the term democracy is a divisive term for anarchists because no one can agree on what it means.
Right.
And so for a lot of people, democracy is often meant to use representative democracy. Mm-hmm. And anarchists certainly don't like representative democracy mm-hmm. because it means giving up your voice and letting someone else make decisions for you. And democracy is often meant to use... to mean the system we impose on other countries so they'll be like the United States.
Right.
You know, two political parties, you know.
I mean, that is a theme I've often heard in Occupy Boston is this, that we don't use representation. We don't send representatives to meetings. We don't, you know, we just don't use that concept of one person representing another in this movement.
Right. And that comes out of, or it's consistent with anarchist theory. But it does raise problems because, not everybody is an anarchist, and there are ways that one person can go to a meeting, in the name of a group, mm-hmm. without being empowered to make decisions, mm-hmm. and that kind of issue is now being talked about in terms of creating a possible spokes council system. Mm-hmm. You know, what is the role of people going from different working groups or affinity groups and trying to work on something together, but not actually having the power to make decisions without going back to those small groups for letting those groups make decisions. Mm-hmm. And so there are different ways of doing that, and some of them I think would be more anarchistic and more democratic than others. And I think that's still up in the air to see how that goes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this also seems to be related to another critique. Sometimes people complain about how hard it can be to make decisions in a general assembly, for example, because there are so many voices and so many opinions, and the consensus, even the Occupy Boston modified consensus procedure, can seem so hard to get, to get enough people to agree. But it seems that another way of looking at that is that a general assembly is really only a place to make decisions that we absolutely have to make for all of us to get with all of our voices together, and that other decisions can sort of descend to the working group level or to even individual autonomous action, and that's not necessarily a problem with the General Assembly. Does that sort of consistent?
I think that's a good point. And in fact, most decisions are not made at the General Assembly. Mm-hmm. I mean, working groups make decisions every day, and the General Assembly might go a week without making a decision. So I think there are a lot of problems with the process of General Assemblies, and I think there are different groups working on trying to figure out what makes sense in terms of adjusting the process, in terms of what values we want to be facilitating. Mm-hmm. And so I think there should be more discussion of that kind. But it is in small groups that most decisions get made. Mm-hmm. And unless a group is making a decision that binds the whole Occupy movement, they can be made in small groups. So if a group wants to do a march, or the group wants to set up a tiny tent project, or group mm-hmm. wants to interact with other people, they can do that, and there's no reason that they have to go to a General Assembly and get permission to do that. And again, that's a very decentralized model of organization, which I think anarchists are comfortable with.
And it has resulted in an incredible profusion of some very creative projects. Sure. And ideas and experiments that are being tried. But I think from the outside,
This show, for example,
as our producer Catherine is pointing out.
Right, I don't know if you propose this show at the General Assembly,
we'd still be discussing it.
To agree on who the interviewer should be and who the guest should be, we might never be here.
Right, but I do also know that because we all talk to a lot of people from outside the movement, and I'm sure we've all heard the same complaints that there's no focus, there's no single message, there's no coherency, and it seems to be very hard for a lot of people to get this sort of dynamism of the small group and the sort of loose general community or brotherhood, sisterhood of the larger group. I think it's very hard for a lot of people to grasp.
Yeah, I think it is, and I think that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think we could do a better job of explaining some basic values, but I think anybody who actually pays attention gets the basic values. Mm-hmm. They might not know what we want to do about them, because we don't all agree on what we want to do about them. Mm-hmm. And I don't really, personally, see that as the role of Occupy, to come up with solutions or proposals. Mm-hmm. For specifics.
Right.
Because the more we do that, the more we end up becoming an arm of the Democratic Party. And we don't need more people in Progressive Democrats of America or MoveOn.org, all these existing groups, and let them do their thing. But that, to me, is not Occupy's function. Mm-hmm. And I think there's such an array, if you look at the signs and the posters at marches and rallies, there's such an array of inconsistent demands and issues that everybody can find things that they like and don't like. And I'm not sure what use it would be to try to decide, well, which of the five things we all agree on. I mean, I have my own sense of what unifies Occupy. Mm-hmm. And different people have different senses. Mm-hmm. But I'd rather keep it vague and general than try to get down to specific demands. And it doesn't matter if people who wouldn't like us anyway don't really get what we're after. And I think part of direct action is not focusing so much on what the media will have to say about us, and not focusing so much on what other people outside think we should do, mm-hmm. but doing what we think makes sense.
Right. I think that's what the Occupy movement is really all about. In some ways, I just say what the Occupy movement is all about, which is probably antithetical to everything we've been saying here tonight. I do want to talk a little bit about. I just want to think a little bit, because the Occupy movement can be one of the ways I like to think of it, is an experiment in new ways of being and new ways of organizing groups of people. And
The experiment is obviously still ongoing, but on the other hand, it's been going on for, you know, what, 4 or 5 months now. Is that right? About, I think. And I just wonder if you have thought or you could think of any lessons that we can learn, maybe by comparing theory to some of the practice in Occupy Movement or the practice in Occupy Movement to the practices in other groups that you know about, if there's, if you can, if we can actually draw, what has what has the Occupy Movement taught us so far?
I think one thing it's taught us is that a large, loud movement of people who can't agree on exactly what we're after can have a huge impact on public discussion and debate. And for the first time in a long time, mainstream politicians are talking about inequality,
right?
Even talking about poor people.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking about how they don't understand what we want, but they know we're pissed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's been really good, that despite all of the lack of focus and despite all of these differences of opinion about how to organize and what we're doing,
mm-hmm.
we've still been able to be spontaneous and innovative and affect public debate. And I think mm-hmm. that's the most important thing. I think that some of the differences, some of the stresses coming up in Occupy across the country mm-hmm. in terms of, and maybe it's also seasonal, you know, we don't have our sites outside and it's cold and maybe we get on each other's nerves more. But a lot of the tensions that are coming out in terms of decision making and process and factions, which I think is happening in a lot of places, come about because we're not doing, including what I think a lot of anarchists should be doing, is we're not taking seriously the idea that we have to figure out how to change ourselves mm-hmm. at the same time as we're trying to change what's out there. That we're so focused on going to meetings and going to actions and putting out information and running around that we're not really paying enough attention to the way we talk to each other,
mm-hmm.
the way we misinterpret each other,
mm-hmm.
the way we're still acting the way we learned in preschool when we learned how to fight each other and like try to stand out and be the person who gets attention. And whatever it was we learned, most of us have never really spent a lot of time, not just deciding to be different. We can all decide we want to be different. It's never worked that well for me, just deciding. And so, you know, I make mistakes and there are things I regret. And one of the things I've been looking at and writing about for the last couple of years is that I think anarchists and other activists should pay more attention to networks of people who have paid more attention to that level of interaction. That a lot of, and some of it comes out of psychology, although I'm kind of negative on mainstream psychology, which could be a source of another discussion sometime. Mm-hmm. But, you know, psychology is a very individualistic endeavor,
mm-hmm.
which I think has a lot of negative consequences. But there are skills that come out of psychology and related areas that focus on how people can communicate better, how people can develop skills of empathy, how
mm-hmm.
we can learn how to listen,
mm-hmm.
how we can make time for people to have input, how we can learn not to hold things in if we're pissed at somebody, but how to express that in a way that can be heard because the other person has also learned the skills on listening.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't do that. And I think a lot of people are now dealing with the consequences of not really knowing how to do that. We're thinking we know how, but we wish the other people would learn how to do that because we're fine, but they're not.
Right.
And so I think that's a lesson that I hope we learn,
uh-huh.
that we can do more of that.
Uh-huh. In terms of democratic or anarchist process or practice, do you think that there are insights or lessons from that the Occupy experience has provided? I mean, besides what you, I mean, some of that you just said.
Yeah.
But,
no, I mean, I think there's been a, you know, you call this an experiment, which I think is good. I mean, you do experiments and you make mistakes and you learn things and you change them. And I think the way we structure decision making has had some positive things. I've seen examples where it worked really, really well, and
mm-hmm.
other times where it seems to not work well at all. And so I think we keep tinkering. And what I hope is that we keep tinkering with different ways of participatory horizontal decision making and not move to some kind of model where people are making decisions for others. Because I think once we start that, it becomes much more easy to be co-opted and end up working in other movements that are organized that way, and you know, and they can keep organizing that way. But I think it's more valuable if we try to figure out how to do it right and different models of decision making, maybe for different kinds of decisions, rather than just give up on it and say, oh, we might as well elect the leader and, you know. Mm-hmm.
Catherine, you sound like maybe you've got a question or a thought back there.
Yeah, if there's time to add in one more question, I'm wondering, are there any models you can think of, like maybe contemporary models that have follow a sort of anarchist principles or participatory democratic principles that Occupy could maybe learn from that were successful? And I'm thinking of, I've heard people refer to Alcoholics Anonymous as being a successful organization that follows anarchist principles. SNCC in the 60s was influenced by anarchist principles, and I guess there are some organizations that have been effective in this country, and I don't know that people are aware of that. And so I'm wondering if you know of any that would be that serve as a good model in your mind, just to kind of inform the process that's going through now.
So which part of our history should we be learning more from?
Yeah, I don't know much about AA. I think that one of the things that came out of the 60s in the large anti-war protests was a sense in a lot of people that one of the problems of mass protest is that people are individuals, and there wasn't a way for people to interact. And so in the 70s, and a lot of that happened here in New England, in the Clamshell Alliance and developing anti-nuclear movement, was to focus it on small groups, small affinity group structures for decision making. And I think that was a good direction. I think people in Occupy today are not going back to that era and looking at the pros and the cons of that kind of model. I think the General Assemblies are probably too large for most kinds of decision making, and maybe they're really important when a decision has to be made right now. You know, the cops are coming in 3 hours. What do we do? Mm-hmm. You know, everyone's there. But when we have other kinds of decisions, something like a spokes council based on affinity groups would be one way of going back and looking at groups that have used that. The affinity group model is, you know, goes back decades and decades. The Spanish anarchists used it in the Spanish Civil War and were very effective in that. So I think those models are probably worth looking at. I think they're probably, and I don't know if someone's done this, but now there are so many different Occupy groups around the country, it would be interesting to see if somebody's could have reviewed them and kind of went through things like decision making and, you know, gave us like a little database of what was working and what's not. And, you know, sometimes little tinkerings help and sometimes more significant changes. So we're becoming our own models. And because every city's doing Occupy differently, right, we really can compare each other and not be so tied into what we're doing and feel such ownership over it.
You have been listening to the Free School University on Occupy Boston Radio, educational programming for the 99%, by the 99%, for the 99%. And we've been talking about anarchy and democracy and many other related topics with anarchist and social psychologist Dennis Fox. So again, we've been talking with Dennis Fox, and Dennis's website, for people who want to learn more about what he's been talking about, he has articles there, is dennisfox.net. You can also, if you go to the Free School University YouTube site, which unfortunately I don't remember the URL for, but if you search for Free School University or FSU on YouTube, I think you can find it. Also, there is a recording of one of the classes that he did, a video of one of the classes he did back at Dewey Square.
You have been listening to a Free School University program that originally broadcast on February 1st, 2012. The Free School University program is educational programming by the 99% for the 99%. Please join us every Wednesday at 7 p.m. USA Eastern Time on Occupy Boston Radio, OBR.FM on your internet browser.